Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Prison Justice Show. Last time, we began to look at prison recreation, you know, the kind of things that incarcerated people have available to them in their free time. It's something that might not seem like that big of an issue, but which has a complicated and storied past and present behind it, so the summary of last time will be a bit long here. What we did was we began by looking at prison recreation from more of a historical and legal viewpoint. People didn't really care much about the conditions of incarcerated peoples until the 1960s, when courts started to use the Eighth Amendment to actually improve conditions, including recreation. Now, this isn't to say that there were absolutely no standards. For example, I believe in the late 1870s, facilities actually began to state that it was their purpose to be more rehabilitational rather than punitive. But when people actually started seriously looking at conditions from more of a legal standpoint, this was like the 1960s. What happened was that the Supreme Court pushed back on this until capitulating to this principle of Eighth Amendment use, which was 2 decades later. When they did so, they created a set of tests called the Wilson tests. These resulted from a couple of different court cases, and these tests were meant to determine whether or not prisons are in violation of providing humane conditions for recreation, relying on the Eighth Amendment's protection against cruel and unusual punishment. Now, I should probably correct myself there. These tests aren't really just for humane conditions for recreation. They're kind of for humane conditions in general, but the stipulation for recreation would fall under these tests as well. And what we also did last time was we noted that humane incarceration is not the same as comfortable incarceration. And we said this really just to get rid of any arguments that we would be trying to make things cushy or soft by, you know, giving people better recreational programs, even though I don't personally think there's anything inherently wrong with this. But this is just to say that even if you're some kind of, basically, like, if you're some kind of hard ass and you think that prison basically shouldn't be a cakewalk for anyone, my point here is that it's still not a cakewalk, and really all it does is it improves conditions to the point where you can actually rehabilitate a person. And so for an example of this, you know, shoving two grown adults into a cell only sized for one person is actually considered all right by these standards, by these Wilson tests, in some cases. It's definitely not comfortable in the slightest, but it's actually considered humane. So the Wilson tests actually have two parts for an incarcerated person to prove, and these parts are actually evaluated differently based on different jurisdictions because, you know, different courts will actually interpret these tests differently. So the first part is that the incarcerated person needed to, quote, suffer serious harm. The second part is that correctional officials were deliberately indifferent to the rights, health, safety of the incarcerated individual, and to do so, they need to establish that officials knew of this unconstitutional condition and chose not to do anything to fix the problem. We spent most of our time last episode talking about the former, the suffer serious harm part. When going over this, the most striking things were that, one, the bar was pretty high to prove serious harm in the first place, with incarcerated people most often needing to show actual physical degeneration to prove this, which, if things have gotten this far, you know, if things have gotten to the point of physical degeneration, that you needed to solve this problem a long, long time ago. You shouldn't be solving problems after people are being seriously hurt. The second thing was that we saw a lot of bad interpretations of good science and statistics, which was used to allow terrible conditions. So for example, you'd have a really good study done by researchers, and then you'd have facilities interpret it, or courts interpret it, in the worst statistical way to basically justify way worse conditions than the researcher would have ever recommended. The third thing we noted was that even based on the bad interpretations, many prisons failed to even pass those standards. So for example, we saw there was something about how, by the worst statistical interpretation of research, a prison would still need to allow, I think it was like 30 minutes of recreation at least 3 times a week or something like that. And some prisons only actually allowed like 30 minutes total per week, and they were still fine to do so. So even based on the science and based on a bad interpretation of that science, they don't even pass their own standards. And the fourth thing we noted was that the actual things required for prisons to do are very little. Like, the standards are very low. Some don't even need to allow incarcerated people outside at all. Some can actually call an incarcerated person's cell, quote, substantial room for recreation if they can do a push-up in there, etc. So imagine, like, you basically just being stuck in your room, but honestly something like half or a quarter size of your room, and then being told, yes, this is substantial room for recreation for you. Just you, this bed, and this space. And then imagine a court actually backing that opinion. Okay, so with that as a recap, last time I spent a lot of time talking about legal stuff, and there's a lot of legal stuff out there to go through, so I'll try to shorten the amount of time that I spend talking about it this time. There are a lot more interesting things like research studies, case studies, actual evidence, etc., that I want to get to espouse the importance of recreation in a correctional setting, even if the legal stuff is interesting in its own right. So to get started today, let's finish up our discussion on the Wilson test. The second Wilson test is about proving that officials knew about your condition and were deliberately indifferent to your rights, health, and safety, choosing not to do anything to improve your situation. The key thing here is to prove, quote, deliberate indifference. Per the ACLU, whom I'll be quoting pretty heavily in this section, here is the definition of deliberate indifference. And this one is specifically in the context of a medical situation, but I think it works in pretty much every situation. So, a prison official demonstrates deliberate indifference if he or she recklessly disregards a substantial risk of harm to the prisoner. This is a higher standard than negligence and requires that the official knows of and disregards an excessive risk of harm to the prisoner. The prison official does not, however, need to know of a specific risk from a specific source, end quote. One example of where this could matter, and which is specifically outlined in the ACLU document, is in medical, dental, and mental health care. Circumstantial evidence can actually be used to pass this test. For example, if there is a deterioration in the incarcerated person's health, like let's say there was a sharp weight loss, like they lost 100 pounds in like a month or something. Prison officials can't escape deliberate indifference by turning a blind eye to these things if evidence shows that, quote, he merely refused to verify underlying facts that he strongly suspected to be true, or declined to confirm inferences of risk that he strongly suspected to exist. Now, what that actually means is basically, if a reasonable person would have thought, hey, this guy's health is deteriorating, you don't get a pass as a prison official if you didn't verify or act further on that thought. If a normal person would say, hey, you should do something about this, you don't get a pass if you're like, oh, well, I guess I wasn't paying that much attention as to what caused that. I saw it happen, but it could have been from anything. Like, you don't actually get a pass for that, per this definition at least. Now, direct evidence is obviously better, though. This is stuff like sick call requests, medical records, complaints, formal grievances, or other records reflecting the nature of the complaint, date of complaint, basically anything that can directly show or confirm what you're saying about how you were complaining or how you had worse health. Any of that is, the best procedure. It's always better to have direct evidence than circumstantial ones. So definitely try to make sure that if you're in this situation or you're advising someone who's in this situation, try to make sure that you can get something material before you have to get to the circumstantial evidence. Now, the standard here for the medical example is that you need to prohibit the, quote, unnecessary and wanton infliction of pain. To determine if serious medical need is an issue, courts use factors like whether a reasonable doctor or patient would perceive the medical need in question as important and worthy of common treatment, whether the medical condition significantly affects daily activities, and the existence of chronic and substantial pain. They can also find serious medical need if a physician has actually mandated treatment, or if the need is so obvious that even a layperson could tell that they needed medical attention. So here you can see that there are a lot of clear-cut things, at least in the medical case, that can prove an official was deliberately indifferent. It's pretty much, if a physician saw it, or if a layperson was like, wow, this is so bad that I think this person definitely needs medical help, or if you can show that it's affecting their daily activities, or if there's the existence of a lot of chronic and substantial pain. So that's basically just pain that you have all the time, and which is at a high enough level. Okay. So there are a lot of clear-cut things on this stance, but it's not this easy for cases of recreation, right? And furthermore, actually fulfilling this requirement doesn't actually improve recreation standards by that much. And I think that's important to remember, because remember from our recap that a cell that was big enough to do a push-up or jog in place was considered good enough for recreation at one prison. How would anyone see that and not think, wow, these are awful conditions? And if you did get physical deterioration during your time in prison, how would you be able to directly tie that to your lack of recreation? Officials could just say things like, oh, he had the room to work out in, he just chose not to, or oh, it was from some other factor in his stay here, and so on. But also, just think of this for a second. If you only had one choice for recreation, and it was a choice made by someone else. Would you choose to do it? And what I'm trying to get at by asking this question is I'm trying to get at people that say things like, oh, well, you know, if they had room in their cell, then they could have, you know, done push-ups or ran or whatever. But again, remember, if you only had this choice and this choice was made by someone else, by like a prison facility or something, would you choose to do it? Now, recreation is one of those things that really help to individualize ourselves, I think. Much of ourselves are tied up in what you do during your recreational time, right? Now, take a minute to actually think about your hobbies, what you like doing. You know, when people ask you, oh, what do you do in your free time? People usually are kind of invested in the things that they do. You know, if you're a runner, if you run during your free time, you know, that's probably a significant part of you. You'll tell people about that. Because this is something that you're not really doing for survival, you're doing it because that's who you are. You know, think about how much these things matter to you, how much they define you as a person. Now, imagine how much a hobby would matter to you. Imagine how much this hobby maybe would even matter to you if it was one, the only thing that you could do, and two, chosen for you by someone else. Well, recreation for incarcerated people is a similar thing, especially when you see the huge lack of opportunities that they have and the huge lack of, I'm trying to think of the word here, but I guess what I mean is the lack of different activities that they can engage in. Now, most people would say that incarcerated people forfeit some luxuries when they choose to break the law. You know, most people would agree with this to differing degrees. But there's a huge difference between forfeiting luxuries and forcing people to make do with the little space that they have in their cell in order to exercise. I know I keep going back to this example, but it's really because this is such an egregious, I guess, situation that I feel like it's worth bringing up a lot. And the other thing is that there's a big difference between forfeiting luxuries and forfeiting nearly all choices of recreation. Even something like providing standard exercise equipment will go a long way towards giving incarcerated people a reasonable choice of what to do for recreation, but it's not actually required by law in most places, you know, if any at all, as per what we talked about last episode. Now, there are many prisons that do provide this equipment, but that doesn't make it okay to allow the ones that don't could that don't, you know, provide this equipment to continue to do so. There should be some kind of legal standard that requires such facilities to have some bare minimum standard that's far above what's currently available. You know, people should not be subject to the whims of their local facilities when it comes to something like this. But when you have to pass the Wilson's two-prong test, there are some very high bars in place that stop significant reformation from happening. It's not that it's bad to have some test, you know. It's just that these tests are not the best. Whether that's from these Wilson tests themselves intrinsically, or the interpretation of these tests by the courts, I'm not personally sure which one it is, but I personally lean much more towards the fact that it's the court's interpretation of these things that's really at fault. But the point is that something needs to change from this testing basis. You shouldn't have to worry about your physical, mental well-being and everything based on whether the recreational facility near you decides, like, oh, you deserve to have a recreational space, or if they're like, no, you should be in this one bunk room with two people and, you know, basically have fun working out in your room with like 5 feet of extra space. You shouldn't have to be subject to that kind of situation. But anyways, with that having been said, let's end our discussion of the Wilson test. So now we'll take a look at some research on recreation in general and some case studies as such. For the following material, I will be very heavily quoting Michael Alexander's paper on correctional recreation. Correctional recreation has a litany of goals and benefits. You know, in a paper by A. Kaplan on the role of recreational sports in the federal prison system, recreation helps to actually change the behavior of incarcerated peoples. Quoting from Michael Alexander's review, which was actually citing Kaplan, recreation programs help to reduce stress, conquer social weakness, and encourage physical wellness, along with promoting healthy physical, mental, and social abilities. The social aspect is especially important when you look at the ideal purpose of prisons and jails in the first place, which is to rehabilitate people to reintroduce them into society. You know, recreation has been shown on this front to teach pro-social values, educate inmates, and promote good sportsmanship practices. You know, there's a huge list of the specific objectives that correctional recreation aims to fulfill. Alexander cites an institutional manual from York Correctional that includes things like improving individual self-esteem, improving mental and physical creativity, improving athletic and artistic skill levels, etc. The list is pretty extensive, so I'm not going to read it all off, but you kind of get the idea from what I said. Other studies corroborate these findings and objectives, such as one by M. Carter and K. Russell in 2005, B. Robertson in a study that actually used a youth environment to prove this, and so on. Now, the main thread between these different studies that I just talked about is that they all show that correctional recreation improves several intrinsic qualities of incarcerated people. What I'm referring to here are things like self-actualization, self-esteem, and self-worth that allow them to do, well, pretty much everything better. It's a weird statement to make, right? Like, oh, these things make everything about you better. It seems kind of weird, but I think it makes sense. And here's why. These self qualities tie into everything that you do, right? They're part of what you are. Can you think of any significant part of yourself that doesn't have to do with your self-esteem, your self-worth, or self-actualization? It's basically what these things refer to is the way that you can fulfill yourself in life, the way that you have a positive look at yourself. And without having a positive look at yourself, oftentimes you tend towards destructive acts, whether they're against yourself or against others. So I think these are things that it makes sense that if you have these things, you basically get to live life better, regardless of whether or not your actual situation changes much. And so the other thread, which I personally think is the most important thread from an argumentative purpose, let's say like you don't believe in psychology for whatever reason, you don't believe in these self things, the most important thing that runs throughout all of these studies is this: these programs enable constructive reintegration into society after release. And that's the entire point of the correctional system in the first place. This makes sense from a basic view as well. You don't need to look at it at some deep study level. If you accept the premise that people are incarcerated because they're at odds with society in some way or form, then the way to reduce these odds, to reduce this tension between them and society, is to make them part of a group, to give them a common purpose, to make them part of a society. And that's what recreation does, right? What else is a sports team but this very thing? It's a group of people who are given a common purpose, who become basically their own little society. But despite what many studies actually say about the topic, most correctional facilities don't really care about the goals or objectives of their recreational activities. Documents tend to be focused much more on what's permitted or safety measures rather than the actual purpose of the recreation itself. And so this doesn't say that documents shouldn't include what's permitted or safety measures, but when you look at the language included in them, they often just seem to care about what they need to do in order to fulfill their legal requirements or something, right? And what that means is that the recreational priority for many correctional facilities is not to promote rehabilitation or the health of incarcerated people, but again, just to fulfill their legal requirements while doing the bare minimum. And that signifies that there needs to be at least some kind of culture shift that, tends more towards rehabilitation. Because as much as people or facilities like to say that they're all about rehabilitation instead of punishment, when you look at their actual documents, when you look at the language that they use, it's very clear that this isn't the actual case. And furthermore, not only is recreation key to promoting the well-being of incarcerated people, but a lack of recreation has disastrous health effects. A paper by R.D. Lee in 1996 showed that prisoners who were kept from interacting with others can suffer from perceptual distortions, hallucinations, hyperresponsivity to external stimuli, aggressive fantasies, overt paranoia, inability to concentrate, and problems with impulse control. So basically, a whole bundle of bad stuff. Recreational ability is the main way that incarcerated people are allowed to interact with each other in a significantly constructive environment. Remember also that many incarcerated people are subject to conditions like solitary confinement or isolation, and we've said many times how awful these conditions are, not only intrinsically, but in the consequences they have on the health of incarcerated people. Well, recreation is a great way to counteract some of these harms, and it's been proven to ameliorate them in many cases. And this also makes sense on a base level, right? If there are a bunch of harms from not allowing people to socialize, then allowing them to socialize would naturally help to fix these harms. Lots of this stuff is a no-brainer, if anyone just thinks about it for a second. But for whatever reason, it doesn't tend to be anywhere on the list of priorities for correctional facilities, which are full of people who should be thinking about these things in the first place. And let's even go beyond the health benefits, right? Like, let's say you don't care about incarcerated people at all. Let's just say that for a second, for whatever reason. Well, there are also big security reasons for correctional facilities to actually want to implement and expand recreational programs. For example, recreational programs give incarcerated people time to be, quote, productively occupied. A. Kaplan, the researcher we quoted earlier, quotes officers that often said things like, "We can't keep inmates busy," or "We can keep inmates busy, or they can keep us busy." Or, "If they don't have things to occupy their mind, then obviously there's going to be other things occupying their mind, like what bank they're going to rob when they get out," or things along that line. So, I'm not saying that I necessarily endorse this specific line of thought, which is these people are intrinsically tied towards, crime or whatever. But let's say that you are, if you do believe this, and these are prison officers, so if you're the kind of person that believes in this, you probably believe what prison officers themselves are saying. Well, again, if you accept this premise, then correctional recreation is what would keep people productively occupied. It actually even helps the correctional facilities themselves to expand these programs despite the expenditures. In a 2000 study by B. Robertson, she noted that many individuals had landed in correctional facilities because they didn't have productive outlets during their leisure times in the first place. What I mean by this is that because there wasn't much for people to do before they were in correctional facilities, they ended up engaging in activities that landed them there in the first place. And again, looking at it from that security viewpoint, authors Frey and Delaney, in a 1996 paper, stated that such recreation allows incarcerated people to release their negative or pent-up feelings, which allows incarcerated people to turn their aggressive tendencies into productive actions. For this, I think anyone's familiar with activities like art and writing, and you're probably familiar with how they've been shown time and time again to be therapeutic to the negative feelings of any individual. They give people a way to express and work through their feelings without needing to act on them in an aggressive manner. Now, if an incarcerated person is able to use recreation as a productive outlet for their aggressive tendencies, they're much less likely to attack guards and other incarcerated people, by that same penchant. It doesn't have to be, art or writing, for example, but it's just the fact that anything that they can do in order to, put any kind of negative emotions towards a productive outlet is something that'll result in this. And the thing is that this also checks out from a statistical standpoint. So, a study by R. Hunter in 1986 showed that after a recreational budget cut, institutional crime rates significantly increased. And just as a side note, he controlled for all other factors like time of year, medical expenditure, etc., as any good study should. So, I don't really want people to think that a good rebuttal to this is, oh, well, maybe the crime rates increased because of something else. He controlled for all of these things within the study. Again, if you want to look it up specifically, the study is by R. Hunter in 1986. So basically, what happened was that the recreational budget, I believe, was cut to $20 per day. I don't know if that was like for the whole facility or for per prisoner, but the idea is that there was some significant recreational budget cut. So before the budget cut, 90% of days in this facility showed no crime within the facility. After the budget cut, this dropped to 75% of days. And so think of it in a better, I think, a framing. That's an increase in crime rates from 10% of days to 25% of days after the budget cut. That's a 250% overall increase in intra-facility crime just from a recreational budget cut and the lack of opportunities thereof. If that doesn't scream the importance of reaction to the facility's security itself, I don't really know what will. Like, that's a 250% crime increase just from cutting recreation. If you're worried about the security of your facility, you should worry about recreation. Now, I've been talking for a while about the importance of recreation, but I don't think that I've really done justice to it. I'm going to end here by quoting an article called Playing the Game on Sing Sing's Field, which actually sums up the importance of such recreation in an eloquent and, in my opinion, rather beautiful way. And this is what they say. While prisoners are taking their turn on the field, while they argue about their favorite heroes on the diamond or on the gridiron, while they discuss the salient points of a noted ring event or exchange ideas on politics or any other topic of common interest, they are not talking about their cases. They forget about length of sentences, they have no time to brood about emotions. They are, during those hours, normal human beings with normal interests. So, during this time, incarcerated people are just people, And when we ignore things like correctional recreation, we ignore the ability that it has to grant humanity in a situation that has very little. With that said, that'll be our show for today. Thanks for listening as always. You can direct comments, questions, and concerns to prisonjusticeshow@gmail.com.